Welcome to Cybersecurity Insights, the podcast for the cybered.io learning community. Our goal is to bring cybersecurity practitioners the latest and most relevant education and training to upskill and dive deeper into topics that matter in today's modern cybersecurity world.
Good day, everyone. This is Steve King. I'm the managing director here at cybered.io. And with me today on the podcast is Johnny Deutsch. She's the CEO and co-founder of Credence, spelled C-R-A-A-D-N-Z. Credence enables finance teams to make well-informed and well-protected B2B payments. He was the former CISO at Rivian Automotive and was with two other publicly traded companies. He led Ernst & Young's offensive security services for 10 years and served 7 years as the deputy CISO for the Israeli Ministry of Defense. What we're going to talk about here today are payment fraud and some of the impacts, the true impacts of this threat across things like scams like business email compromise, et cetera. So welcome, Johnny. I'm glad you could join us.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Payment fraud is a multi-billion dollar business and I think is cited as among the top risks to companies all over the world. And I think something like two-thirds of U.S. corporate finance departments have reported some form of breach that not only cost them money in the last year or so, but also, you know, hurt their reputation. What's that trend like and what's causing it?
Thank you for that. So the trend is massive, right? Just like you indicated, and it keeps on going up and up and up. And if you look at the data, it really depends on what data you're looking at, because we also kind of conducted a research with Quantum Institute, but the FBI has their own data statistics on what normally is coined as business email compromise, right? And it keeps on rising and rising throughout the years. So we specifically see the ability to either impersonate vendors or breach vendors, which tends to be a higher likelihood that happens over time, is one of the common trends. Nowadays, of course, we have AI that helps the attackers craft and draft an even more idyllic email to help them deceive the target itself. And it's kind of just where we're at right now.
Yeah, no kidding, we do. And that, you know, CyberEd's business is about helping people learn how to recognize these things, and particularly in the light or with the new light shown on the space with generative AI. What does the average business email compromise look like from your experience and research these days?
Sure. So it really depends on the sector that you're in, right? If you look at a lot of the sectors that get hit the most when it comes to these types of areas, these are sectors that have the most amount of vendors, right? When we conducted our research, we found that on average, companies have around 2,800 vendors. That's kind of the average size. If you look at companies that have revenues of about $400 million, so not too big, not too small. And so you could just imagine the multitude of deception that gets perpetrated on these companies because of the supply chains.
So $400 million company typically has over 4,000 vendors it's paying, is that correct?
2,800 vendors, that's the average.
Oh, 2,800. Still, that seems like a lot of payments to me, but
it's one of the things that happened, right? People don't even think of the amount of vendors that a company would have, right? When we start our own discussions, when we go to finance, how many vendors do you think you have? A lot of times the conversation starts, well, I think we have 600, maybe 500, right? And then they go back. Companies manage their vendors in what's called a vendor master. They go back to the vendor master and they get the full list and then they see the number and they're like, well, you know, it's a bit more than what we thought and it's in that average.
Wow. And are most of those, let me rephrase that. Is most of the growth in that vendor volume metric due to SaaS vendors, let's say over the last 5 years?
There's a lot of growth because of a lot of services, to your point, that gets kind of outsourced and externalized to the companies. So definitely. But, you know, if you look at specific industries, there are certain industries that are just dependent. If you look at manufacturing, hospitality, or real estate, right? just the sheer nature of their business is highly transactional. So you have to have a lot of vendors in order to manage the business itself and be able to actually create any value in the market. But you're absolutely right. There's even more vendors now that we're in this SaaS age of everything gets innovated into it. And we've seen it as well, because all of these vendors will have their own billing practices, which means that these teams now need to truly understand whether or not what they've just gotten is an email with an invoice that looks kind of fishy, but hey, no, that's actually the way this vendor bills, and it could change from any one of these 2,800 vendors.
Yeah, wow. How do you address that? You've described a pretty messy problem space, that needs a lot of kind of eyeballs on it, it seems to me. I mean, because it starts with, higher level controls and it gets down very granularly. I mean, do you look at every, $5 a month subscription fee for a piece of software in Department X? And do you scrutinize that? Or, how do you get people to understand that this is a real threat?
No, it's a great question. So before the threats themselves, right, you're asking how do companies actually fix this, right? Like, what's the way to remediate this?
Yeah.
Sure. So the first thing that we do, and we truly believe it's not just us, right? It's just a good way of solving it. We come from cyber, right? And I'll give it as an analogy. In cyber, one of the more complex areas that people deal with is vulnerability management. Right? I mean, I've been a CISO at 3 different companies. Vulnerability management is always a challenge. And the reason why vulnerability management tends to be a challenge is due to an area that has a lot of issues, which is asset management, right? You always play whack-a-mole with your vulnerabilities because your asset management is not necessarily as up to date. Now, that analogy holds in finance as well, because finance has their vendor master, which is that giant list of all these vendors that they keep on maintaining. They add on, they remove vendors, some become active, some become inactive, the business relationship changes. Again, that whack-a-mole process happens. So that's why the first place that we actually touch is the vendor master, is to help companies clean up the vendor master to a point where they know who they're paying and it's all above board and they know exactly the details that they have on their vendor. So that's the first place that you truly have to make a change, because everybody thinks that it's all about protecting the payment itself, which of course is very important. We do that as well, but you really have to get down to the basics and start cleaning up the vendor master.
Yeah, are there any banking regulations that serve to protect companies from fraudulent payments as part of their banking relationship vis-a-vis the credit card liability that the banks take on for fraud?
It's a great question, because there's always that assumption, right? You always assume that if you're going to lose money, the bank is going to help you because the bank was part of this. You moved the money through the bank. So the bank should have told you, hey, this is malicious. You shouldn't do that. But actually, that's not the reality when it comes to corporations. It is very much the reality when it comes to private individuals. For example, if somebody would deceive you in your own private banking, then yeah, the bank would have some form of liability on it and they would try to make it right on your end. But when it comes to companies, there is no liability for the bank itself. And anything that the bank might do is more of a relationship play to ensure that you're good and you're still going to bank with this bank, but they have no liability. And the reason is because companies need to have their own internal controls that they govern the process by which they manage their vendors, they manage their wiring instructions, they manage who can approve a transaction and a transfer. That's why there's really zero liability here when it comes to the bank itself, and 100% liability on the company itself.
Do you guys audit these controls as part of what you do?
Yeah. It's exactly one of the things that we do, because we look at the controls themselves of how do you onboard these vendors? How do you specifically know that you onboarded the right vendor with the right details to understand if we're looking at the right data sources to validate this, and also down to the transactions themselves. So funny enough, Steve, we actually developed a methodology that's called FinSecOps, Financial Security Operations, that helps companies understand how do we integrate security into the process of finance, right? And so it's exactly part of what you're just referring to.
It's pretty easy, I would think, to intercept a SaaS transaction when you're, you know, like signing up with a membership or a subscription with ABC, whatever. And then especially if the DNS is not secure, and then redirecting that to a site that, you know, is designed to look exactly like the site you think you're signing up with, and so forth. How much of that is part of the threat problem here?
You're right. You went to kind of the more advanced scenario, I would say, right? The majority of what we are seeing either lies in two areas, either an impersonation of the vendor that you're working with, or the third-party compromise, right? Someone that's actually from your supply chain gets hacked, and the attacker now controlling that specific inbox has the ability to communicate with corporate finance and then guide them into making either a change to their bank account details, either a change to the actual payments that they normally make, right? So these are the more two common scenarios. There are other scenarios that we also deal with, like internal fraud, but at the end, you know, it's much simpler than you think.
It's much simpler than you think to do what?
To actually get companies to make payments and change payment instructions.
Oh, yeah, sure it is. And no matter, you know, and the one of the statistics that keeps hanging around my head is the fact that, you know, 10 years ago, I think you can trace 95% of breaches to human factor in one way or another. It was an error, mistake, misconfiguration, failure to whatever. And so over the last 10 years, we've spent $60 billion in security awareness training. And lo and behold, 10 years later, 2023, we have exactly 95% of breaches that can be traced to human factor at the source. So none of this has worked. What do you think about that? What conclusion do you draw?
So I'm always an avid believer in social engineering education, right? I mean, if you look at my background, you know, because I spent about a decade doing red teams, I was for quite a long time on kind of the attacker trying to manipulate the person in the company to get them to sign up, give out their credentials, right? So I got to see at firsthand social engineering, how effective it is as someone that had performed these assessments. So I remember that, you know, before I became a CISO, I was very, you know, I didn't have the most, you know, positive view of security awareness. But when I turned to be a CISO, at the first company I was a CISO, I did see that it did have an impact, right? So when you're in security for many years, just like, you know, I've never worked in any other job than security, right? Since the age of 18, that's all I do. And my whole world is consumed by security. So I have a lot of assumptions on what looks legitimate and what looks fishy. But what security awareness does is that it extends that view to people that don't come from the same walks of life. And that's why it is effective, right? Now, is it as effective as an actual technological control? No, it is not, right? So it is important to be able to spread the message around and to give more people the proof that, you know, this is what you guys need to do. This is how you should be thinking about these things. But we need to keep in mind and be cognizant that it is not a technological control. And Steve, I'll also expand on that, right? If you ask companies right now in their finance operations, how do you guys prevent from these types of fraud happening? They will tell you security awareness is one of the tools that we're using. And I always say, guys, just keep in mind, it's not a tool. It's just an additional awareness, and it's additional awareness of what you should be looking out for, but it's not really a tool. It's good that you're doing it. You should keep on doing it. But, you know, I have a statistic that follows me from the research that we've done, is that 27% of organizations terminated employees responsible for making payments that are malicious payments. And I look at these 27%, and I keep on thinking of the people, right? Like, okay, have they been through awareness training? Well, probably they have, but they lost their job because of the company not implementing an actual control, but just putting like a pseudo control, which is just awareness training. So effective to a certain degree.
Yeah, it doesn't help anybody that they've lost their job either. I mean, you know, they're even replacing them with somebody else who needs to have that same level of awareness, and you don't have a good process for that, then that's going to be hard to do, you know.
No,
what are your thoughts about the whole reputational damage issue? And by that, I mean, you would think that a company like, Clorox, maybe Capital One Bank, who get these outrageous cyber breaches, suffer these outrageous cyber breaches, that people will look at that and say, you know what, I don't think I want to do business with those guys anymore. But that never kind of seems to be the case. So I think it was Target, wasn't it, that, you know, they took a equity market hit for about, I don't know, 14 months or something, but the stock came back and outperformed where it was 16 months ago right after that. So, you know, I always wonder about that, because we in the industry use that a lot as, you know, cautionary tale. You know, it's not just the cost, but it's the reputational damage. But people don't seem to care one way or the other, it seems to me. What's your experience with that?
Well, going back to that survey, that we did, right, 60% reported damage to the organization's reputation itself. But I'll be honest with you, it comes down to the people, right? When something happens like this, when you lose money, when finance loses money, the tear to the reputation tends to be much more personal, right? You have this department that has these controls and, you know, in a very simple matter, just, you know, do not lose money, right? Let's make sure that you keep our money to our own goals and don't have it fall into the hands of, fraudsters. And when you lose that, you lose trust. Now, losing trust is like a slow, piercing process. You lose trust from the board. You lose trust from your managers. The team loses trust. It's something that takes quite a long time to repair. And that's why it is important. Now, every company goes and deals with it and, you know, their own way. That's why I think that what your initial point, it's very hard to compare and contrast breaches that had happened and try to kind of understand how does the market judge them, right? I believe it's down to the people. It's down to when a process that you were entrusted to ended up failing because the wrong controls were not in place or the wrong processes were not in place. It's your own personal reputation that got tarnished. And that's why people are very minded to these processes.
Yeah, you would think so. if you lost your own PII and it caused you, well, Move IT is a classic example of that, forcing people to do all kinds of stuff that they would otherwise not have to do just to recover now, you know, and it's really a horrendous waste of time and unnecessarily complicated as well. So, you know, I feel badly for those people, but that attack continues to go on. I mean, we're at 20,000, I think, companies right now. And every month it feels like we go up another 1,000 companies that are discovered to have been attacked by that third party threat vector. So, you know, my question kind of goes back to why. So my wife is pretty good at this now, you know, so she'll say, hey, look at this email, and I'll look at it. She'll say, it looks squirrely to me, and I'll say, what's the URL say? And she says, it ain't the right URL. And I say, great. And then she says, okay, I'll unsubscribe. It's like, no, don't unsubscribe. So, and that's not a criticism of her. She's so much better than she's used to. But why isn't that whole process automated? Why don't we have email gateways or control systems that actually go through that exercise? You know,
or go through any set of exercises that we think are the right kinds of controls to automate that whole process so that we don't have to make those decisions?
It's a great question. When you go down to the underlying elements, right? Do we have companies right now? If you're a corporation, right? Any CISO or security engineer that's listening, I would ask them, so do you have any email security gateway, right? Like the Mimecast, Proofpoints of the world? And most of them would say, yeah, of course we do. And then you would look at the statistic that the FBI shares on BEC, business email compromise, and it still grows year on year. So yeah. There's still vendors that do that, right? To your point, automatically try to weed out these emails, but fraud still proliferates. It's rising tremendously. So why is that? And when we try to answer that, we understand that at the end, we call it BEC and we assume it's all about phishing, but good business email compromise is much more than phishing. It is true fraud perpetrated via media that is email, right? And when you look at what the controls that are set to find phishing are all about, they're all about looking at, like, are there any malicious attachments in the email to understand if the URL is something that would steal your credentials. There are about 3 to 4 main scenarios when it comes to phishing that most technologies would try to automatically find and detect. But fraud is truly words. It is truly social engineering at its finest, trying to convince you to do something that is above your authority to do that and circumvents controls. And that's why these tools don't have the capability and they will never be able to truly trace that, because they lack context. And what's that important context? They lack, who do you normally work with? Is this the actual company that you're used to working with, or is this a subsidiary of this company? Is this a company that you're used to transferring funds to, right? Well, you know, if you're an email security gateway, you don't get to peer into the bank account and see all the transactions this company actually does. Keep in mind that at the end, these companies, the email security gateways, also get judged on their false positive rates, right? You don't want a tool that keeps on saying wolf, wolf, right? That in between where you don't have to truly fish someone, you just need to be able to social engineer them into doing specific things like changing bank account details, right? Or changing the amount that you bill them, things of that sort. That's nothing to do with the technologies that exist nowadays in terms of email security. I always say right now, yeah, sure, we're used to getting these things through emails. But as we advance and we accept more methods of communication like WhatsApp, text, and anything that we integrate, those channels will be inundated with it just as much. That's why it's not getting solved.
Right. So final question, if I might, advent of, you know, setting aside the clown show that's been going on for the last 4 or 5 days here, the advent of generative AI is provided, I think, an extraordinary opportunity to do some of the things that you just talked about. Do you see the future of this space improving through leveraging generative AI tools to know more, to learn more, to do it faster, to make those kinds of checks and determinations more quickly and more efficiently than we have historically?
So I'll share, like a funny moment that I had. I went to a CFO leadership council about a few months ago. And I remember I walked into a session that talked about adopting generative AI in finance. And they had this quick survey on the screen where it asked all the participants of whether or not you think of integrating AI into your controls and into your finance processes. And a whopping 78% said no, right? That they're not considering it. And then I took the mic when it was the time for the questioning. And I said, well, how many of you think that AI would be used against you, if not by you, right? And then the whole audience started talking about this. And the host of the session started talking about, you know, the advent of fraud in these events. And, you know, they're understanding, but I do believe that AI can do a lot in terms of thwarting this risk, which is what we do on our end in the product. But I truly believe that as we started this conversation with security awareness, I think that a lot of the people that fraud is perpetrated against only hear about AI, but they're not fully aware of how much it will affect the amount of additional fraud that will be created as part of this. There's always a good side and a bad side of things, but it is just a sheer reality. And unfortunately, companies are not adopting fast enough these capabilities, whereas attackers and fraudsters definitely are.
Well, that's a fittingly depressing way to end this conversation, Johnny. I know, great story though, and that number will stick in my mind. That's fantastic. You know, it's just amazing. You know, you can get the horses down to the water. You can simulate drinking. You can stick their heads in, but if they ain't going to do it, they ain't going to do it. And I, you know, I've been beating my head against the wall in this space for a million years. Why do I keep doing it? Because I'm an optimist, I guess. And by the way, as the Israelis will say, losing is not an option. So, right? So there's no way to stop this. There's no way to give up the fight is what I'm trying to say, right? We have to win this war. In any event, thank you so much for joining us again. To our audience, this is Johnny Deutsch, is the CEO and co-founder of Credence. Thanks for taking the time, Johnny. I appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to our audience for spending another half hour with us. Hopefully it was fun for you as it was for me. And until next time, this is Steve King, your host, signing off.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Cybersecurity Insights. You can connect with us on LinkedIn or Facebook, or send us an email at social@cybered.io. For more information about the podcast, visit cybered.io/podcast. Until next week, stay safe and secure, and we'll see you on the next episode of Cybersecurity Insights.